Welcome to the New Jersey American College of Physicians student podcast channel. My name is Ali Harb, and I'm a fourth-year medical student at Rowan Virtualis School of Osteopathic Medicine.
My name is Thomas Gunning. I'm a third-year medical student at Hackensack Meridian School of Medicine. Today on our podcast, we have a new episode where we will be recapping many of the highlights from the 2024 New Jersey ACP scientific meeting held in Princeton Marriott at Forrestal on March 8th.
We had so many fantastic speakers, and the day was filled with quite a bit of excitement. I know for me, this has been my second year attending in person, but I know for you, Thomas, this was your first meeting. What did you think of the day?
Yeah, Lee, for my first time, I thought it was great. Even as a third year medical student, I took a lot away from these talks, and there were a ton of opportunities for students to participate throughout the day. I can't wait to return in 2025, and it makes me even more excited for the ACP national meeting in April.
Without further ado, we're going to jump right into our recap, where we aim to take you through the major highlights of the day and summarize some of the key takeaways from each of our speakers.
The morning started off with a welcome from the chairs and introduction of the governors. We would like to start off by giving a huge shout out to our current ACP New Jersey governors, Dr. Nayan Kothari and Sunil Sapru, for their service to the chapter, and would like to congratulate the chairs of the conference, Dr. Kathleen Pergament, and our governor-elect for the Southern District, Dr. Daniel Goldsmith, for a very successful 2024 annual scientific meeting.
This was followed by three early morning lectures, the first of which was given by Dr. Jeffrey Carson, provost of Rutgers Biomedical Health Sciences, New Brunswick, and longtime faculty member of Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical. He is also the principal investigator and study chair of the MINT trial, which was discussed as a critical piece of his talk on red blood cell transfusion in cardiac patients. Dr. Carson's talk began with a review of risks of transfusion and risks of anemia. He discussed risks of transfusion such as HIV and hepatitis C that he had mentioned were very low. Also, he talked about trolley as an important side effect, but taco as a much more common side effect. But the risk of blood from known problems is actually very low, quite comparable to other medications that we often take for granted. Nevertheless, he emphasized a key point that we have to consider when deciding to transfuse patients. Let's hear a short clip from that part of the talk.
Whether to consider transfusion, it is not about the risk in most situations, because the risk is low. Rather, it's about whether the stuff works, whether there's efficacy. Do you improve clinical outcomes? If you don't, why would you ever expose patients to the adverse but uncommon side effects of blood and the expense of it and the fact it's a finite resource? So it's really about the efficacy, and that's what we're going to concentrate on for a lot of this talk.
This propelled Dr. Carson into a greater discussion on the landmark trials on whether transfusion has an impact on clinical events. He was able to discuss key conclusions from the TRIC trial, FOCUS trial, a GI bleeding study by Villanueva et al. He also talked about work that he did on a Concord meta-analysis on differences between liberal and restrictive strategies, the reality trial, and lastly, his very own MINT trial. Regarding the impacts of transfusion, more specifically on cardiac patients, I thought there was a really interesting part of Dr. Carson's discussion where he shared a key discussion point when considering whether to employ a liberal transfusion strategy.
Patient is transfused using a liberal threshold, there's a very small chance that you don't benefit that patient, okay, because the confidence interval overlaps one, okay? But the relative risk of 1.15 and the upper confidence interval 1.34 suggests that there's a clinically significant benefit, somewhere approximately 15th up to 34%, that the patient will have less recurrent MI or die within 30 days. This is the key thing to understand.
To wrap up, Dr. Carson spent some time discussing the most updated 2023 international guidelines on red blood cell transfusion. Dr. Carson emphasized what restrictive strategies should be used and should there be a different threshold for different subgroups. The major takeaway here was that a 7 hemoglobin threshold should be used for hospitalized adult patients who are hemodynamically stable. But based on a restrictive threshold used in most trials, clinicians can choose 7.5 for those undergoing cardiac surgery, or 8 for those undergoing orthopedic procedures or those with pre-existing cardiovascular disorders. In closing, Dr. Carson shared some remarks on what he considers to be a good practice strategy.
Now, a key point that I want to leave you with, and maybe the most important point of the entire talk, is we have what we call a good practice statement, that we consider it good practice in deciding when to transfuse in particular patients to consider not only the hemoglobin, but also signs, symptoms, other lab results in the overall clinical context. Don't just use a number. Okay, the trials put you in the ballpark about when you should be thinking about transfusion. But you need to individualize this, look at your patients, examine them, talk to them, oh my, and not just base everything on a hemoglobin concentration. That's what we mean by a good practice statement.
The second talk of the morning was Making Sense of Long COVID with Dr. Sabiha Hussain, an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. I think Dr. Hussain framed her talk really well here.
And I don't think anything has transitioned us so rapidly as COVID has in the way that we practice and the way that we're going to practice in the future. The whole field of medicine is going to change. And to be honest with you, it has to change.
Long COVID has been this really challenging concept for me and I think a lot of other students to understand. And she really took the time to go through the theories and what we believe the pathophysiology to look like.
The pathophysiology of long COVID is not well understood. A lot of the data that we're getting are based off of a lot of observational case studies that are being grouped together. And based on that, we're having theories that are coming through as potential causes of long COVID.
To address this emerging concern of that is long COVID, Dr. Hussain's team had two really crucial approaches. The first is that she was working with the COVID health needs assessment, which is now being built out to include questions, including long COVID, and questions to include specific patient populations of interest, such as healthcare workers.
The takeaway from the health needs assessment were three. One, that there should be education around long COVID. Two, that there should be advocacy for individuals, because a lot of the people that we interviewed, patients that we interviewed, felt very abandoned. They felt that they were not heard. They felt that most people did not think their symptoms were valid. And so that was very difficult to hear when we interviewed these individuals. So there was a push for advocacy. And lastly, what we found is that there is a lack of data alignment throughout the state in terms of what's going on with long COVID, not just in the state, but throughout the nation. And those are the recommendations that we put forth to the New Jersey Department of Health.
In addition to the health needs assessment, Dr. Hussain has been working with long COVID patients in her own clinic and has brought to the seminar a couple of key takeaways.
Occupational and physical therapy, nutritional support, all of those things are actually working better for my patients. And so the approach that we have is a multidisciplinary approach. I have a social worker on my team. I have a nutritionist, a physical therapist. I have a cognitive person who screens all of them when they come into clinic, and a fatigue specialist. They're all embedded in the clinic. So when the patient comes, they can meet with all of them.
Towards the end of the talk, I think it was really important to hear from her what she thinks the best takeaway was and how we can best change our own practice of long COVID patients. And here's what she had to say.
I think for a long COVID patient, honestly, the only thing you really need to do is validate them. In talking to these patients, that's the one thing they felt most hurt about. The fact that their physician didn't believe them. They were really hurt. And I could understand that. You know, I think as physicians, we have to say, I hear you. Even if we don't understand it, I think we have to say we hear you.
The third morning talk was the evolving landscape of HFpEF with Dr. Kupreet Barn, cardiologist at Deborah Heart and Lung. His two big takeaways for the management of HFpEF patients were here.
I think one main one is that all HFpEF patients should be on SGLT inhibitor. That's a guideline recommendation, and we need to spread that message. And secondly, study that considers screening them for amyloid.
I think what surprised me most about his talk was the SGLT2 inhibitors and how they really have the most evidence of any of the potential GDMT drugs for HFpEF. I think, you know, we see so much of the data being focused on HFrEF that we sometimes forget about what is available to treat HFpEF patients. And seeing that SGLT2 inhibitors are now the only class 2A recommendation really shows how important they are and how crucial it is that we are bringing these into the clinic for our patients. I was also really impressed by the data on the cardioMEMS. These were really new therapies where we're able to detect these subclinical changes in pressures and adjust their medication accordingly. He's talked a little bit about the outcomes described here.
So we have two trials. There's a CHAMPION trial that was done about a decade ago. People forgot about this trial. It was a 500-patient trial, which showed it was class 3 heart failure patients, and they got cardioMEMS, and it showed a reduction in hospitalization. A lot of people don't remember this, actually. It was the first trial that the subgroup HFpEF patients had a benefit as well. This was the first intervention, actually, even before SGLT inhibitors, but it never really picked up steam. And then we have the larger trial that was done recently around COVID time, a guided Jeff trial. DeBoer was one of the sites. It was a multi-center national trial, and that showed the same thing, reduction hospitalizations.
I think this was a valuable reminder how important these reductions in hospitalizations are as a clinical outcome for these patients.
Following Dr. Barnes' talk, the conference took a short break to enjoy the resident student posters and abstract exhibit. I had some time to catch up with one of our early career physicians, Dr. Raman Bala, during the break. He was able to share with me a little bit about what the early career physicians group in the ACP does.
My name's Raman Bala, and I'm an academic hospitalist at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, and I'm currently serving as co-chair of the ACP Early Career Physicians Group New Jersey chapter. We are a dynamic group of physicians, and we are dedicated to supporting early career physicians as they navigate their professional journey, where members can access resources, network with peers, and engage in professional development opportunities. Our mission is to be the professional home for career and personal development. We recognize that a lot of early career physicians are trying to figure out their individual paths, whether it's in academic medicine, private practice, inpatient, outpatient, entrepreneurship, administration, leadership, etc. Engaging with a community with similar interests can be invaluable. And whether you're a more seasoned physician looking to collaborate or mentor, or an early career physician eager to connect, this group offers an excellent platform for growth and collaboration. To share a personal anecdote, when I initially became an attending physician, I thought my merits alone would help guide my career development. However, if I had recognized from day one how valuable connecting with physicians who had been navigating their careers already, or collaborating with physicians who share similar interests, then I would have been able to accelerate my journey earlier.
What projects or initiatives are of highest priority to the group right now?
The ECP prioritizes initiatives aimed at career advancement, professional growth, and community engagement. Some of our highest priority projects include mentorship programs, educational workshops, networking events, and advocacy efforts to address the unique needs of early career physicians in New Jersey. At the ACPNJ annual scientific meeting, we're looking to expand our mentorship program with those interested in being new mentors, as well as mentees looking to connect. So please come join as we grow our community further for the benefit of early career physicians in New Jersey. So getting involved is easy. Early career physicians can join the ECP group by becoming members of the American College of Physicians and indicating that they have an interest in joining the ECP community. From there, they can participate in events, volunteer for committees, and take advantage of the resources and support already available.
Dr. Bala also served as a poster grader at this year's conference, and I was curious about what experience that was like.
It was an honor to serve as a judge for the poster presentation competition at NJACP, the annual scientific meeting, and I have to admit, it was a lot of fun, too. As a judge, my role was to evaluate and provide feedback on the posters presented by participants, particularly focusing on the content, presentation quality, and the overall contribution to the field of internal medicine. There were multiple evaluators per poster presentation. As for the number of posters, there were approximately 50 presentations showcased at the conference. It was quite a diverse set of topics. The most prevalent presentations I ran across were case reports, a significant portion of which highlighted rare presentations of diseases. However, there were also some great poster presentations discussing more common diagnoses with atypical features or challenging aspects involving diagnosis or management. There were also a handful of QI-related projects that stood out. Overall, the experience was incredibly rewarding. It was inspiring to see the dedication and innovation demonstrated by the participants in their poster presentations. Each poster offered unique insights and perspectives, making the evaluation process both challenging and enlightening.
The conference then reconvened for the two late morning lectures.
The first of which was on the intersection of health and climate change with Dr. Bushra Saleem, nephrologist at Capital Health. This was all about the case of mesenteric kidney disease, which is also sometimes called chronic kidney disease of unknown cause. This is a non-traditional cause of chronic kidney disease, often presenting in young males who are oftentimes agricultural workers. Previously, this has been documented in Central America in situations of excessive heat stress, especially in patients who are not routinely consuming water while working, or even taking in sugary or alternative beverages. Dr. Saleem clearly depicted by a case series at Capital Health in New Jersey that this is prevalent here in our own state, with a demographic that very similarly presents in young males who are doing outdoor work in hot environments.
Our next talk was on the role of the internist in reproductive health with Dr. Glenmarie Matthews, an assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at Rutgers University at the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. First, Dr. Matthews did an incredible job with the framing of her talk. Even for a New Jersey-focused conference, it was clear why this was a national issue.
So why do we care about abortion? Dr. George Tillard, who was really a spectacular man, said that the woman educated me and taught me that abortion is women's hope, it's their dreams, it's their potential, and it's the rest of their lives. Abortion is a matter of survival for a lot of women.
And as we've seen this landscape change, so have the outcomes.
Roe versus Wade became a thing where they said it was the legal right of someone to be able to have access to abortion. What that did for us, if you look on this graph here, is that, remember, this happened in 1973. Lots of abortions were still happening before that. The morbidity and mortality from abortion in the United States before that was significantly high. Once Roe versus Wade was passed, people were able to have safer abortion. So the morbidity had significantly decreased.
After she was able to really highlight New Jersey and focus on the opportunities and resources that we have for patients here.
What does that mean for New Jersey? What is New Jersey abortion law? So all the time while this Dobbs versus Jackson was happening in 2022, our state was thinking, okay, how are we going to make sure that we protect ourselves? So we then had something that's called the Freedom of Reproductive Choice Act, which explicitly signed the rights for abortion into law in the state of New Jersey. So New Jersey's a good place to live. What that means is that we have no gestational age limit. We don't have any parental involvement or requirement for these services. New Jersey Medicaid, like I stated before, allows you access to abortion services, and medical abortion can be obtained via telehealth, which is not something for a lot of other places. And in fact, we went even a step further by now also allowing for mid-level providers to be able to perform abortion services.
And for me, I was really interested in what was one key takeaway that I, as a future internist, should be bringing into my clinic. And here was her response.
Takeaway I would say is that we are all a united force, and together we are all taking care of women or non-binary people that will need any of these services, abortion or contraception. Don't be hesitant if you're faced with an individual like that. You always have a friend in an OBGYN, and now you yourself have been guided with the tools of how to talk to the patients. So just feel empowered to even open up that discussion, and I've provided you with the resources that you can use.
After Dr. Matthews' talk, we were able to enjoy the presentation of some awards and a fantastic lunch, followed by the final lecture of the day on AI in medicine with Dr. Naveena Yanamala, who is the Director of Data Science and Machine Learning at the Center for Innovation within the Division of Cardiovascular Disease at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. Dr. Yanamala talked a lot about the history of AI and the growth of deep learning with large language models and the increasing strength and computational power within this. Started with implementation in radiology with x-rays, but now touches so many more aspects of healthcare, going beyond where the human eye cannot recognize certain patterns. Nevertheless, Dr. Yanamala had a great take-home piece of advice for our listeners when thinking about AI in medicine when moving forward.
Use technologies, but use it in an appropriate manner. Have all those bells and whistles that I have talked about, challenges, and still have your statistics hat on when you do this. Thank you.
The day wrapped up with the oral presentations from some of our New Jersey medical residents, the resident and student challenge bowls, and lastly, the award center. Hey, Thomas, I know this year you participated in the student challenge bowl. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah, I think it was cool getting the chance to work with students from my own school and test our knowledge in, you know, a new type of format. We also don't get many opportunities to engage with students from other medical schools, so this was a great chance to do so.
And Thomas, I think that's a wrap.
I agree, Lee. We'd like to thank everyone for listening to this podcast recap episode of the 2024 New Jersey ACP Annual Scientific Meeting. And we look forward to seeing everybody back next year to the scientific meeting in 2025. Thank you.